Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Empty Frames is an independent production. The commentary expressed here is our own and does not reflect the opinions of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum or its staff. To learn more about the museum, including the 1990 theft, please visit the museum's website at www.isgm.org. If you have any critical information relating specifically to the 1990 theft, please contact the museum's security director via the options provided on the museum's website. The museum continues to offer a reward totaling $10 million for information that can lead to the return of the stolen artwork.
We are bothered by the loss the art world suffered in 1990, and we are not content with the status quo.
One stolen painting to note is from Manet, a French artist who created Che Tortoni, circa 1880. It's an elegant depiction of a man sketching a half-consumed beer on the table as he calmly looks at his audience. We started this podcast to raise awareness of the theft and to show our support for the ongoing recovery efforts. While those recovery efforts progress, as they do daily, we encourage our listeners to visit the museum, to appreciate its incredible collection, both past and present, and to donate directly to the museum through its website.
Again, if you enjoy this podcast and you feel as we do about the missing artwork, the most productive way for you to express your view is to donate directly to the Gardner Museum via its website. Go to isgm.org and look for the Join and Give tab, where there are options to make a donation of any size to support the museum's mission. Please donate today.
And when you do, let us know on Twitter so we can personally thank you there. Thanks again.
On March 18, 1990, the most audacious art heist of all time took place at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. Two men dressed as police officers were admitted into the building by security, claiming to be responding to a disturbance call.
In 81 minutes, 13 pieces of art were stolen. Among the portraits stripped from their frames were works by Vermeer, Degas, and Rembrandt. Estimated at $500 million, the heist has been categorized as the largest and most frustrating of all time. Theories of their whereabouts and those who perpetrated the crime are abundant.
In this podcast series, we will dig as deep as possible into the case, the theories, and the social and economic impact the greatest unsolved art heist of all time had on the community. This is Empty Frames, a heist story. Welcome back to Empty Frames. I am Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawl Space Studios. What's up, Lance?
Oh, not too much. How are you today?
Doing great. We have an interesting episode to bring our listeners today. For the bulk of the episode, we'll be talking to Brendan Cieco, who is the CEO of QZeum, whose project Hacking the Heist got a lot of publicity back in March around the time of the anniversary of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist. So we're going to play that in just a few minutes. But first, we wanted to bring these outtakes from our episode called Security Breach with Marge Gallis, who worked at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum at the time of the heist, was not there that night, but worked there at that time and knew all the players involved, at least a lot of these people that we talk about, like specifically the two guards who were on that night.
Randy and Rick. She spoke of both of them very highly, but what really like gave our put our antenna up was that how highly she spoke of Rick. And we have some of these moments that just didn't make the last episode, and we wanted to put it out there because we don't want the listeners especially Rick Abbath, who was, you know, notoriously connected to the heist because he was there. And you have the picture of him duct taped down in the boiler room. So we've heard that he listens to the show, and we don't want this to be an anti-Rick platform. It's certainly not by any means an anti-Rick Abbath platform.
Right. And I think when you start to look into the Gardner case, that's one of the immediate assumptions you jump to. And I think that's maybe something that we looked at, but we always took the point, well, if we could prove that he wasn't this inside source, then, you know, we're really getting somewhere with the podcast. And I don't know that we're about to prove that he wasn't the guy, but personally, I don't think he was. There's kind of nothing to suggest that he definitely was the inside source.
Right. Other than him being there and letting them in. And you know, the speculation of, well, if this was done so easily and people have gotten away with it for so long, there has to be an inside source, because that's just what your brain does when you try to put these things together and be your own detective on it. But we do have some just interesting things that when you dig into the old articles that were written about it, we had Mr. K send us a couple of articles that he found reread and found a couple of points in there that were interesting. One was from a 1992 New York Times article, which suggests that the Blue Room was a destination spot for any thief. And the quote was that there were three other paintings that normally hung there that were temporarily in the museum's laboratory for treatment. And that raises an interesting concept when you think about these three other paintings, that if the thieves knew were in there but didn't know that they were out for restoration,
was there an inside source at all?
Wouldn't the inside source say, don't even bother going in there, because those three paintings that have a significant value aren't there anymore? You know, it just doesn't make much sense.
Okay, so let's play these few minutes from our chat with Marge, and then we'll be back to wrap it up.
You portrayed Rick in a very different light, I think, than most do. And I'm curious, do you think that the scrutiny of him is really misplaced? And if so, do you think there's anything he could do to kind of definitively establish his innocence?
That's a curious thing. I don't know what Rick's life has been like, you know, post that time. I've read that he lives in New Hampshire. It seems like he's married, maybe. He's a teacher, apparently. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting that it seems like he just doesn't want to answer any questions. Having the opportunity to have been a reporter, I've encountered those people that don't want to really do interviews because they've been misquoted or their comments have been misrepresented. And I even had an experience like that myself, where I just did this little article for someone and they misquoted me. It was kind of a minor point, but it did make me feel like, wait, that's not what I said. And now that makes me sound really stupid. So, I mean, I don't know if part of his reaction is just he's tired of the way that he's been portrayed and he just doesn't want to have any involvement with it anymore. It is unfortunate because of that, because of the way he's handling it. It does make it seem like, you know, he's got something to hide, maybe, or why isn't he just saying, you know, this wasn't me? Or I guess with that tape with Larry, I guess the tape was brought to Rick to check out, and he didn't even want to look at it. He wasn't going to comment about who he thought the person was. So, you know, I feel like he could do more, but again, I don't really know what his situation has been like since that time, and you know, the different people that have been in touch with him, and you know, the scrutiny about the Blue Room and the stolen painting from that room, and the fact that he was the last person on record in that room. So, you know, it, without really knowing much about him anymore, just it's hard to say. It's such an interesting thing right now with the way people consume and regurgitate information. I think a lot of people, if they hear something or if it comes from a specific source, you know, like this whole fake news, the term that Trump has made so popular, but there's an element to it that that actually led to him being elected. You know, people would post something, or someone would see, oh, a friend shared this link, oh, it's going to be they shared it, so I'm going to share it. Oh, it's interesting, I'm going to share it. Without really questioning, you know, what's the content of this? Is this accurate? Who's reported it? Is this person a real reporter? Do they have that sort of background to, and you know, to be trusted, to feel, can I feel like they've done their investigation and their due diligence, and what they're presenting me is as factual as possible? So I think, you know, people kind of jump on bandwagons, and I kind of feel a little bit like that's what's happened with Rick. You know, like I said, he was a clever guy, and he did do things. At a certain point, he was making money by hosting band concerts in his basement, for instance, which I guess is probably illegal. But, you know, he was a clever guy, and he figured out how to do that. Does that make him a crook, you know, or does that make him a thief? I don't think so. He was a guy making some spare cash, and bands got heard and no one got hurt.
Okay, so I think that's pretty interesting stuff there from Marge, and I think she makes some good points. And it is totally possible that Rick has been unfairly treated by the media. And I want to add that, like we said before that clip, the only thing that even really kind of remotely suggests that Abbott is guilty of being an inside source is this blue room motion detector that says none of the thieves went in there to get the Che Tortoni, but the Che Tortoni was taken out. Also, he let the thieves in, but they were dressed as cops. So if he was an inside source that had coordinated with these thieves, they wouldn't have to dress like cops.
Exactly. That seems like a futile task, right? Sort of a frivolous thing, almost for fun. You'd be, because I mean, the fact is that they were dressed like police officers, so that if he was an inside source and he knew that this was about to happen, that would mean that they only dress like police officers just for the thrill of it.
Right, so I guess what I'm asking is, I want to know more about these motion detectors from the Blue Room. Could they have been faulty?
So how many times on record have there been false motion sensors that have gone off in the past? You know, did it happen after the fact too?
You also mentioned these articles that Mr. K sent from a New York Times article in 1992, where they were comparing this theft that was unsuccessful to the Gardner theft, and was talking about the thieves being proficient in disabling a moderately sophisticated electronic alarm system in this attempted Hyde heist. But it also said that happened in the Gardner heist. So am I missing something that the thieves disabled a moderately sophisticated electronic alarm system? Because that's what the New York Times in 1992 said.
Well, it does show a bit of confusion, right, of with the details that are out there. As far as we know, right, there hasn't been anything saying that any sort of alarm system, whether it was the local alarm system or the one that goes to the police, nothing had been disabled. All we know is that a videotape was taken.
In Steve Kirchen's Master Thieves, it talks about some moments that the alarm system had that night. So maybe that is part of this. I really don't know. I'm confused. But what we're saying is we need to get a little more information about this motion detector, because it seems like they missed some of these steps from the actual thieves anyway.
Or it could be that on top of some information that is disseminated that is not accurate. Like the two articles from 1992 that Mr. K forwarded to us, the Yankee Magazine article, which just says that the thieves ignored those three paintings that were being restored and a John Singer Sargent painting and went with the Che Tortoni.
Right.
So they didn't realize in that article that those three paintings weren't even in that room.
And this motion detector doesn't detect the thieves going back down to the basement to check on Rick at one point, even though we were told that happened. So I guess I'm questioning the validity of these motion detectors.
I just want to reiterate this, right? The devil can be in the details a lot of the times. And you have what's detected in the Blue Room. We have what we know was not in the Blue Room, which was three paintings of extreme value. And we have somebody who worked at the museum who could have told the thieves that they weren't in there, don't bother going in. So the question is, if the three other paintings had been taken, if they were there and they had been taken from the Blue Room, would Rick still be accused of removing the Che Tortoni himself?
I don't know.
Right?
And in Marge's full interview, she mentions that if Rick did go into the Blue Room to take the Che Tortoni off the wall before the thieves arrived, which is sort of what the motion detectors suggest, that it would have been in the sight of Randy, the other guard. He would have had to have walked by him. It's not like the Blue Room is really far from where he would have been sitting.
And as we know from the interviews that we've done with Marge and Jeffrey Rockwell, they communicated through the walkie-talkies pretty often when they were, you know, especially on the overnight shifts. You almost wanted to do it just to make sure that the other person was still alert, you know, was still with you. And if you're going through the museum, if you're leaving your security desk, I mean, you also know that the security video is being taken of you leaving the desk as well. It just doesn't, I know a lot of listeners might be thinking something happened behind the scenes where we were told to not talk about Rick in a negative light, but it's not that at all. It's just us getting as deep as we've gotten into this and looking at old articles and having discussions with Mr. K and our guests, including Marge, and then saying, well, yeah, some of these things don't make sense about him being an inside source, and we don't want to make it seem like we're anti-Rick.
I don't know. We've done 11 episodes now, and we haven't found anything that points to him definitively, or any inside source definitively. In fact, actually, I think we've, if anything, uncovered the opposite.
We've uncovered that something that could quite possibly be an outside source that hustled their way in and just checked out things on a surface level and then delivered that information back to whoever actually perpetrated the crime.
So if you're confused by this conversation, rest assured, we are too. But we are trying to get some more information out about these motion detectors, and we would love to hear from Rick Abbath. So, Rick, if you are out there listening, please send us a note. We would love to talk to you as much as we can.
And it can be off the record. It could be you know, chat with us via email, maybe a phone call. We figure out where to go from there. And say what you want and tell us not to use what you don't want us to use.
Okay, so now we are going to play our interview with Qzeum CEO and founder Brendan Cieco. Can you tell us about your project?
I live and breathe art and technology. And a couple weeks ago, some members of my team were talking about some interesting new ways that we could push the limits of augmented reality. We had been working very closely with some of the new possibilities that are enabled by Apple's AR kit and working in the museum atmosphere to test some of those new concepts out. And I came back from one of my recent prototyping sessions, and a member of my team was like, hey, you know, it would be really cool is if we put the stolen art back in the frames at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. And, you know, abracadabra, we gave it a shot and it seemed to work.
Yeah, it's a pretty cool project when you look at it. It's called Hacking the Heist. And this is an offshoot of your larger company, Qzeum. And it's all very like interconnected and relatable. Can you tell us a bit about what Qzeum is about?
Yeah, Qzeum's primary mission and goal is to help museums, public attractions, and cultural institutions engage their visitors, members, and donors using the power of technology. We're based in Boston. We started a couple years back with that, you know, with that vision in mind, and have been able to work with over 150 institutions of different shapes and sizes on a variety of different digital engagement endeavors. So it's, you know, again, it's something that we're all super passionate about, and being able to work with these organizations that have such a critical role in society, it's something that we wake up excited about every day.
Very cool. So Hacking the Heist, so you can take a device, a tablet or an iPad or... And you can hold it in front of the empty frames on the wall at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, and you can see the actual paintings through the tablet as if they were really there in their frames. How do you view this if you go to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum?
So this is, you know, this has all been an experiment, an independent experiment, kind of an R&D type of endeavor here, you know, here at QZM. And so it's something that we never, we never intended to be publicly accessible. And of course, we would want to, make sure that the institution was endorsing that and comfortable with that. So at this point in time, it is not available for public access or consumption. It's not something we've, despite all of the interest in from the public, it's not something that we have made public to date.
But you can go to the website hackingtheheist.com and you can see the results of this project, and then it will take you to QZM and you can look at, you know, everything that company has to offer. This new way to walk through a museum and experience the artwork. And we do know that the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum is very, and as most museums are, very particular about what is captured there. And I think keeping it private the way you're keeping it is probably in everybody's sort of best interest.
I mean, there's so many ways to go about technology, and in specific, looking at augmented reality. In some ways, we live in this wild, wild west with regards to where the virtual world, the digital world exists. Who owns that? Who owns that space? Who owns that opportunity? And a lot of those initial conversations were opened up around, you know, some of the earliest examples being Pokemon Go or Snapchat's art project. You know, it's still a very interesting nascent space, it's interesting to see the dialogue that projects such as Hacking the Heights have started, and will continue to spark.
What was the Gardner's Museum? What was their reaction to it?
I can't really speak on behalf of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. So if you're looking for an official statement from the museum and their team, it'd probably be best to reach out to them directly.
Yep. Okay.
Same reaction we got from the podcast.
For sure. I mean, we're Bostonians. We're neighbors. We support the Gardner. We go to the Gardner all the time. We have conversations from time to time with staff that work at the Gardner Museum. So there had been, instances of staff at the Gardner knowing about what we're working on and asking about it and things of that nature. That's kind of the unbiased reality of something like this. And when it comes down to the visibility of an experimental project, I mean, this is here to inspire people. It's here to showcase the new realities around what technology enables. Because I think for a lot of people, the idea of augmented reality is fairly abstract. And it's something that, from the top, Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, has announced kind of his excitement around how this will transform the way we interact with education, the way we interact with the world around us. And so for us at QZM, we feel very strongly about creating experiences that are educational, that are enriching, that are tied to the world's culture, maybe as compared to, you probably saw a couple weeks ago, like Street Fighter came out using augmented reality, and gaming certainly has a big splash in that space. So to create something that, shows the beauty of the art that was previously on display, for instance, or raises awareness about the heist, or raises awareness about what the works even looked like. For us, we quickly realized most people don't know what the works look like. And that's kind of an interesting thing as you're walking through the museum and you pick up that pamphlet that has outlines of all of the frames and objects and has a key with different numbers inside those frames. And you're like, that doesn't tell me really anything about the importance of that Rembrandt or that Vermeer or what it looked like. And museums in particular, being as visual as they are, we, felt that it would be so inspiring and also a testament to Isabella Stewart Gardner herself, who was a pioneer and a visionary and kind of experimented and kind of you know, did things on her own, you know, intuition that interested her. We felt that it would honor her, you know, legacy, especially in, you know, in this month.
It sounds like there's a part of, you know, because you're a huge proponent of the arts, and you're a young person, and I get the sense that there was a bit of urgency to introduce, like, how do you introduce to a younger group of, you know, millennials, how do you introduce to them the beauty of this artwork, the tragedy of the stolen artwork, and then even, you know, the person who is Isabella Stewart Gardner? And I feel like your projects here are just a good marriage that brings together two worlds that probably, I guess, need to be brought together. Was that in your head when you were coming up with all of this?
I mean, that's part of my, you know, my life's commitment right now is looking at the intersection of art and technology and how museums need to adapt or die, and they need to look for new avenues to engage their audiences. And the reality is the way people communicate, socialize, and see the world is through technology, is through their mobile device, is through all of these different avenues. And so to be able to, you know, capture the attention of various types of audiences, you know, this isn't solely dedicated or you know, geared towards a younger millennial audience. I think the beauty of something like this is that it's magical for people of all ages and demographics and education levels and technical literacy, because it's just very straightforward and simple. But yeah, it's something that we feel really strongly about. And you know, you're seeing, I think it was was it last week that the local NPR station did a piece about some of the steps that Boston's cultural institutions are taking to engage younger and more diverse audiences. And technology is a critical part of that, any way you slice and dice it.
We come across a lot of people who, you know, well, anybody comes across a lot of people who are, you know, they're terrified of technology and computers. But Hacking the Heist and even what you do with Qzeum isn't much different from, you know, picking up a pamphlet while you're walking through a museum. You still have a reference. You're still looking at something right now. But what you're doing is just putting it, you know, you also have your phone in your hand anyway. So people shouldn't be scared of this technology. It's not daunting.
Every experience you have is mediated, whether it be walking through and reading interpretive text or holding up a pamphlet, it's completely mediated. The outlet for that mediation or that content is the thing that changes.
So how did you test this technology?
I think it was a couple weeks ago, we even decided to try this out in the real world. I mean, we've been doing a lot of experimentation around augmented reality as of lately, and specific to this type of experiment, it was late on a Thursday during one of those late evenings where the Gardner's open to like 8 or 9 o'clock. And I was at the office pretty late. And I'm like, you know what, I'm going to head over and see if this even is technically possible. Not to go too far down like the geek path, but a lot of the things around augmented reality are incredibly exciting, but at the same time, technically challenging. And so there are some things that we needed to see if they were even possible around your device's ability to recognize a vertical surface, aka a wall, as well as an image, to be able to position an overlay in an environment with variable lighting that is super, super dim compared to other environments. And one of the key components to any of this AR stuff is light, to be able to achieve that. So we're like, will this even work? And headed over and saw that it worked really, really well, and then put it on the back burner because we're, you know, working on a bazillion projects at once, and then kind of, you know, hadn't touched it until a couple days before the anniversary. And then we're like, hey, like, I didn't even realize there was like a St. Patrick's Day party at our office on that Friday. And I was in a conference room after a call, and I'm like, like, I feel like it kind of sort of happened in March, and then realized it was that Sunday.
How long does it take to create one of the paintings that is augmented inside its frame?
So, you know, from the visitor perspective, it's instant, but from the programmatic perspective, I mean, it takes several hours and testing and tweaking and, you know, seeing how all of the elements perform. So that did take a little bit of time and trial and error.
Cool. And how many, it says you're planning to add more of the paintings. How many have you done to this point?
Yeah, so we, we focused on the two Rembrandts in the Dutch room. And, you know, the natural progression would be to have all of the works in the Dutch room taken care of. So, of course, the famous Vermeer. But we haven't really moved forward or had time to test that out. But it's something that hopefully we'll be able to jump on and experiment with. Yeah, so far, I mean, just looking at those two particular paintings has been an exciting journey.
So if you could choose one of the 13 stolen pieces of property from the museum to have back, if you could just choose one that you could see back in its frame in real reality, which one would it be? Have you thought of that?
No, I haven't really thought of it. It would probably be Christ in the Storm. Just based on it being the only seascape that that Rembrandt did, yeah, it's really hard to say. I mean, I would defer to whatever Isabella Stewart Gardner would want returned if she were alive and today. Yeah, I mean, that would be a huge triumph for the for the museum and for Boston and for the world to have back in its collection.
Are there any other projects like this that you have on the back burner? Anything that has to do with any other heists or stolen property, or you're keeping it local and keeping it to Boston for something like this?
I mean, it's something we have a couple projects that we've been experimenting with just around visual culture and different interpretations of two-dimensional artwork and giving them a new dimension and a new purpose and a new capacity that people can access them in. I think what's been really exciting for us is all of the surprise or unintended dialogue that this has started and looking at something that the committee that oversees African museums posted something saying, wouldn't it be great if this was something we did to show culture that has been taken from our country and is in the process of being, restituted. And I think that's a really extraordinary reaction to think about how much of the world's culture is endangered, how much of the world's culture has been stolen from its country of origin. I know I have a really strong reaction about, art that was looted during World War II and some of the works that have not been returned or are still lost. And so, for anybody or any of your listeners who have seen Monuments Men or followed any of those stories that I feel are in the art news every other week, I think the idea of being able to show the works that were previously held in a nation's collection, or even just thinking about, the work that was recently unveiled in London, that was a recreation of a piece that was a sculpture that was destroyed by ISIS. I think it's just it creates a dialogue around just how precious the world's culture is, and how even temporarily, I mean, the permanent, the permanent solution to this stuff is to have the work returned to its rightful owners, but in the meantime, using digital to create a dialogue or show what something looked like to tell its story, I think is a great, powerful way to use technology.
Inc. Magazine, named you as one of the most successful 30 under 30. Their famous 30 under 30 list. What does that feel like as an entrepreneur like yourself? How does that feel when you get named in that mix?
I mean, it's incredibly humbling and always feels a little undeserved, but it's something that I think there's this new energy around what young people are able to create. And I think, like a lot of young people, I see very few obstacles. And if we have an idea or if I have an idea, we leap at the opportunity to engage in that idea and to bring it to life. It's a really exciting and energizing feeling. It's gratifying. I think, I'd be nothing And I'd be nowhere without the support of my mentors and people who have been, you know, helped me be the best entrepreneur that I can be.
Great. That's awesome. How big is QZM? How many employees do you have?
So we're nine. We're a nine-member team right now, but we are growing. So we're looking to hire a few new members to join the team. So if there's anybody listening at home that finds what we're doing interesting, give us a shout. We're always looking for, you know, passionate people that want to drive this mission and vision forward.
Very cool to see the two worlds come together, because I thought that I appreciated art, and then we started working on this Empty Frames podcast, and then once you see it and you're, you know, up close and you experience it, it's a whole different you know, world once you're like face to face with, you know, Van Gogh or something, or walking through Isabella Stewart Gardner's museum. It's nuts. So
yeah, I mean, there's so many layers to the experience, and I think for most, like, we're first scratching the surface and finding our place and what connects with us and what we connect with. And then you get deeper and deeper and you realize, oh my God, there's so many layers to this onion. And then it becomes like a positive addiction to be like, oh, well, I wonder what he or she was thinking when they created this work of art. And I wonder who they were influenced by and what technique they used and what impact this had on the world around them. So I feel this, and you guys feel this, and it's a beautiful thing to be able to experience art, especially here in Boston, where we have such amazing museums and collections that are, you know, here for us.
When did you first get into art? Like, when did you first realize that you were a fan of fine art?
Yeah, so I kind of, my story, like, I'm the middle child of five children. My mom drives a school bus and my dad is a plumber, and we didn't really go to museums. We didn't really go to Disney World either, but it wasn't something that we talked about. It wasn't something that we did. But my interest in design, I don't know what it was. I do know my parents, like, encouraged me to draw, and that was something that was always important to me. If you asked me when I was 8 or 9, I wanted to be an animator or a cartoonist or an illustrator. And that evolved into an interest in design. And so my interest in, like, the fundamentals of design evolved into kind of pop art and maybe street art. So I remember maybe being 12 or 13 and being at a punk rock show and seeing something that Shepard Fairey designed, maybe for an album cover or poster, and went home and kept thinking about it and needed to find out more about it, and saw, wow, this is actually considered art. And here are some other artists that influenced this creator, this designer, this artist. And then that started to evolve into an interest in, more specifically going to museums. So I must have been 16 or 17. I remember being really interested in Roy Lichtenstein and having the opportunity to paint a mural at my high school that used our school's mission statement. And in the speech bubbles, we would have each of the fundamentals of that mission statement. And for me, it was kind of like, I knew at that point I was interested in modern art and contemporary art to some extent, although not knowing, you know, how, the depth and breadth of that world. And, you know, as I have freedom as an adult, I started going to more and more museums. And that is what really opened my eyes, like this experience of walking through and having a new world open up to you that when you were little, you didn't really have exposure to, you didn't really feel that there was a place for you there. And I think especially being in Boston and having the access that I do has been really eye-opening, just to see the beauty and the importance and all of that. So art has definitely kind of impacted me as a person, where I think of myself as being very, having a very sharp eye for aesthetic and an appreciation for aesthetic. And that's something that developed, I think, later in my teenage years and earlier in my 20s.
Thank goodness there are people like you who are shaking the cobwebs off what is perceived to be sort of like a stuffy institution of museums, because they're not. They're very riveting, and they're very thought-provoking. But we were nervous that there would be a contingent of people who would just think that, you know, you hear the word museum and it, you kind of start to, you know, it just feels stuffy. because it's, you know, you just, if you don't know, if you're not, you know, if you're not part of that world, if you haven't really experienced it firsthand, which you really have to do. And, and what you do is a great, like I keep saying, it's a great integration between the two worlds.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, you can either look at museums as a traditional sanctuary. And when you look at them that way, you're isolating a huge, huge portion of the population, or you can look at them as a playground for new ideas, or a center for community, or a center for innovation, or a hub for different walks of life and perspectives. And I think, you know, most institutions, at least at some degree, have had conversations or made efforts to align more with that latter concept. And so it's something that the sector talks about more and more as demographics change, as the environment change, as attitudes towards art and culture and things of that nature evolve. So yeah, I mean, something I'm super excited to see the evolution in.
Thank you very much for listening. Follow us on Twitter at @empty_frames.
Empty Frames is a co-production of Crawlspace Media and Audio Boom, with original music by Jared Jansen.